Welcome, folks, to the very first episode of Sports Out of Time. I haven't come up with a catchy analogy or shorter title for this yet. Randall, before we get started,
yeah.
I have to give you credit. This was your idea. A lot of people ask me, like, did you come up with this? I say, no, this was Randall's idea. So let me ask you,
sure.
So far, recording all this material and just having it go nowhere and nothing happened with it yet. I was staring at your computers. Is this everything you hoped for when you said, let's sign up for a podcast?
It is everything and more. I couldn't have expected anything better than this. I'm excited to get it going, right?
And let's do it. Sports Out of Time, episode number one. Let's go.
Yes.
Right, folks, welcome back. Sports Out of Time, episode one. Welcome back from the intro that we just had just moments ago. as you can tell, it's been a while since I've been back to podcasting. I, of course, folks, am Sam Familaro, joined as always by my co-host, co-producer, Randall Bailey, all the way out in Illinois. How's things, man?
Things are great. Everything's going well. The weather's been beautiful, so I can't complain.
Yo, another good thing I forgot about with podcasting. Yes, it's beautiful here in upstate New York. It's almost 80 degrees out.
Yeah.
And I forgot that when I have to record in my space here, I have to close all of the windows and all of the doors. And it's now stifling in here. So I'm very excited for that as well. Good to be back in the swing of things. And yeah, of course, I am sort of back in the podcasting game, even though I told myself that I wasn't going to do it, at least personally. But then you pitched this idea to me to do this show. And
sure.
And I don't want to say that I was not as receptive as I could have been. I think I was a little curmudgeon-y just in general about podcasting, but I liked the idea.
You were. It took a little. I think I pitched it a few times.
It had nothing to do with me not enjoying the idea, because we had talked about this when you were a guest on the Uticast. We had discussed this back then, as even then was sort of a side, what do we call it? Like a backdoor pilot to this.
Yeah.
And then exactly. after I was done, I was just like, nah, I'm done. I'm so tired.
Right.
I'm so tired.
No. And I remember us having discussions and I could tell you weren't ready. You were still burnt.
No, and I have to say it's actually been very exciting getting back into it, because I forgot how much I liked all the aspects of this show, of doing podcasting, that I do enjoy, like having great conversations,
right,
digging into stuff that we haven't before, things that I would not have otherwise. That's all great. Plus, I don't have to really do like any politics or talk about nonsense that I don't feel like talking about anymore. So I'm not as depressed all of the time, which is a nice bonus.
Absolutely.
So before I get into just some housekeeping stuff, Randall, I got to ask you a question that people have asked me on the street, mm-hmm, when they see me. And
sure,
I've talked about going back into podcasting. They keep saying, Sam, what is this show? So I'll ask you, Randall, in your opinion, what would you like Sports Out of Time? Sports OOT is the closest I've gotten to shortening it to anything. What are your opinions on what this show is going to be for us or for you?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question that people on the street are asking you. And the way I look at it is this, you know, when you're at a family function or you're at a party and you're with a group of people and you start talking sports and half the group, they tune you out, right?
Yes.
They're not really into sports. And, you know, you're talking about current day events. Hey, did you see the game? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you can go on the radio, you can go check out any billion podcasts and hear people talk about the game last night, right? So to me, I always wanted to talk about sports in a different way, talk about stories that are from the past that are interesting and unique, maybe unique to me, maybe unique to you, maybe to other people, but they're stories that I think you can tell in a group of people where they don't tune you out immediately, because they're interesting stories that are more all-encompassing. And it's something that someone who's not really a sports fan or not a sports lover like we are can at least listen to the story and be like, oh, that's a pretty cool story. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I'm gonna have a quick tangent here. So I was on one of my deep YouTube dives last night. I was watching. Yeah. I don't know why. This is a whole different thing. I was looking at the best and worst movies of 1994 according to Siskel and Ebert on their television show. So I watched all of it. And in 1994, they both picked the number one movie of the year they chose for 1994 ahead of like Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction was the documentary Hoop Dreams. And one of the things, which is a phenomenal documentary if you've never seen it. And one of the things they said in it is there are things that happen in this documentary that if you wrote them in a movie, people wouldn't believe them. But because it's real, it all feels so much more dramatic. And I think that's what a really good overarching feeling about how sports in general is. There are things that happen in sports that if you wrote them, people wouldn't believe it. But they're real and they happened. And sometimes we just forget about them.
No, you're absolutely right. That was a great way of putting it, without a doubt.
And that's what I was also thinking about with this show is just the moments. For me, initially, it was the moments that sort of stuck with me. When we did our pilot episode that no one will ever hear, it was mostly things that were important to each of us, right? And we'll cover a few of those over the course of this series. But really, as it's gone on, it's really just, for me, it's been about the moments and the people that I didn't understand the relevance and importance of, like didn't realize their impact in ways that are both sad, mostly for me, sad and uplifting. I don't know why I picked so many sad ones.
You're only choosing what speaks to you, Sam. I mean, that's all you can do.
So what we have coming up on the docs, coming up down the road, we will, of course, be talking about Drazen Petrovic, the world's shortest baseball player, Eddie Gradel, Catherine Switzer, the man who saved wrestling, Tim Woods. We have a couple more that I won't spoil for right now, but those are some that are coming on down the road. So you can sort of get a vibe for where we're going with this. Might as well do some quick housekeeping here before we get into this week's debut episode. Number one, while we haven't gotten everything up and running yet, that's just the way it is. There are some places that you can reach out and follow the show currently. You can follow us on Instagram. You can follow us on Twitter. This show, of course, will be available on SoundCloud and Spotify and Apple all over the course of the next couple days or so. So, you know, bear with me. It takes time for those to upload. But over the next couple days, and they'll be on the same three platforms that the Uticast was on. I don't know exactly, for all you former Uticast listeners, I don't know exactly if I'm just going to co-opt the old stream. So if you were listening to the Uticast and suddenly a new podcast is taking over that stream, now you know why. We're back, sort of. But again, Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, Instagram, Twitter, Sports Out of Time on most of those. I haven't set up a Facebook because I hate Facebook so much.
Right.
I know I'll have to do it. I just don't really want to. It's the worst. But we'll get to it eventually. And I guess just one last thing here before we get into this week's episode. If you notice when we get to this week's episode that my voice sounds terrible, and for all the former Uticast listeners joining who will notice that my voice sounds very nice right now but will sound terrible in a moment, it's because I didn't upgrade until a nicer microphone until about four episodes in. So you'll know at some point in time, you'll go, hey, Sam sounds a lot better, but Randall sounds great the whole time. So don't worry, that's only a temporary inconvenience,
right?
So let's get into our first week's topic, which was December 17th. I'm sorry, not December 17th, January 3rd, 1993. The comeback, Frank Reich. This was your choice, Randall. And we'll get into why you chose this in just a minute when we get into the episode. I appreciate you picking a Buffalo Bills thing right off the bat, though. It's very nice of you.
Well, I knew it would be bad form if you did, but I could get away with it.
So I might have a Bills thing coming up down the road. We'll see. at the time, this was the largest comeback in NFL history. This was actually broken just recently. December 17th, 2022. The Vikings and the Colts, that was a 33-point comeback. I will say, though, this is still the largest comeback in a playoff game ever. So so that outlier still exists for this game.
A little bit more meaningful game.
A much more meaningful game.
Much more meaningful.
Much less hilarious, though, than the Vikings blowing it to the Colts. But neither here nor there. Randall, I won't hold us up any longer. Let's get to episode number one The Comeback. Randall, I was just lamenting how exciting I've been feeling about getting back to podcasting. I'm like, you know what? This is really making me feel good to talk about all these sports stories. What's the topic of our conversation today?
The topic today is the comeback.
Hey.
So have you now, if you go on Wikipedia and type in the comeback for American football, this is what comes up. Mm-hmm. So the comeback was an NFL game. It was held on January 3rd, 1993, as part of the 92-93 NFL playoffs. And in this game, the Buffalo Bills, your beloved Buffalo Bills,
absolutely,
overcame a 35-3 deficit to defeat the visiting Houston Oilers 41-38 in overtime. And they set the then record. It was a record then for the largest comeback in NFL history. Okay.
That's right. A record up until this year, December 17th, 2022, as the Minnesota Vikings come back 33-0 down against, who was this they lost to? Oh my God.
That was the Indianapolis Colts.
They beat the Colts. And the Colts will play an important part of my discussion later on when it comes to one Frank Reich. But that's a little later on. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, this 32-point comeback is still, however, the largest comeback in NFL postseason history. Okay. Now we probably all remember the comeback that the Patriots had against the Falcons. Mm-hmm. They were down 28-3 with like 2 minutes left in the third quarter, and they ended up winning 34-28. But this one actually is the largest comeback in NFL postseason history. So pretty cool. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background before we jump right to the game, just to give listeners an idea of what was happening in 93.
I love it. I'm so excited. I can't wait.
And just so you know, my sources are Wikipedia, and there was an article on ESPN.com from Elena Getzenberg. So it really outlines this well. That's kind of where I'm getting this source material.
I love it.
So prior to this game in 1993, the only time in NFL history that a team failed to win a game that they'd led by 30 or more points was a 38-38 tie in 1960 between the Buffalo Bills and the Denver Broncos. Hey. And that, in that game, the Denver Broncos rallied from a 38-7 deficit to tie it at 38, which wound up being the final score. So in 1993, the Buffalo Bills, they had been the AFC champions the previous two seasons. Okay. In 93, they had a record of 11-5. It was the 92 regular season, I should say. They finished in second place in the AFC Eastern Division to the Miami Dolphins, after losing their final game of the season to the Houston Oilers.
The deep history between the Oilers and the soon-to-be Tennessee Titans and the Buffalo Bills it makes me sick just thinking about it already. I'm like, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no problem. So Buffalo had a no-huddle offense, and they led the league in rushing yards. They ranked second in the league in total offensive yards. The main keys to their success would be their future Hall of Fame players on offense: Jim Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, James Lofton, receivers. And they also had Hall of Fame defensive end Bruce Smith. And he went on to become the NFL's all-time leader in sacks before he retired. That, of course, has since been broken as well. But they were a pretty stacked team. Obviously, 2 years they had been in the Super Bowl, and in 92-93, they were looking to go back. So meanwhile, the Houston Oilers, they finished second in the AFC Central Division with a 10-6 record. They had a run and shoot offense that led the league in passing. So where, you know, both teams were pretty offensive powerhouses. Its defense was actually third in the league. And overall, this team boasted 9 Pro Bowl selections, headlined by Warren Moon. He made the Pro Bowl despite missing 6 games with injuries. And they had 3 wide receivers who were out of this world. So let me take a step back regarding the Oilers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have one thing I just wanted to say before I get too far away from it, before we get into this thing, because I went back and I watched the highlights of this game last night in preparation, and I'm looking through at all the players, and you've named a lot of great players. And as I went up to look at the rosters on both of these teams, something came to my mind and I could not stop thinking about it. And I just had to look it up. It was something going all the way back to 1991, but for me, it was 1993. It's something called Tecmo Super Bowl for the regular Nintendo and Super Nintendo, because all I could think to myself when I was looking at this, I was like, oh my God, these are all the players from that game. Right. Yes. This is Warren Moon. This is like Lorenzo White. This is Jim Kelly, like so many studs. And that game is so ingrained in my brain now that that's all I could think of while I was watching this. I'm like, oh my God, give it to Thurman Thomas. He's the best player in the game.
Exactly. That's awesome. And that's a great memory to draw from because I'll get it. My memory from this game is interesting because when we get into the game itself, mm-hmm. I believe again, my memory is questionable at best on most days, and it's non-existent on others, right? So I recall being at the Chicago Boat Show when this game was being played and seeing it like every once in a while. I don't know if there were bars or restaurants that had TVs in the McCormick Place in Chicago, and seeing this game on TV here and there. And of course, the first half we'll get into was a total blowout. Yeah. So I thought the game was completely just done. But, you know, as we know, it's called the comeback for a reason. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about the Oilers, because there may be some people who are like, who are the Houston Oilers, right? I mean,
what a shame.
I know, it really is. Because the Houston Oilers moved to Tennessee in 1996. They eventually became the Titans in 99. But the Houston Oilers, I thought their uniforms were awesome. I liked the Columbia blue, the red and the white was their color scheme, right? And the oil derrick on the helmet was cool.
It was unique in the way that uniforms from the 90s were unique and felt special, right? Again, back to the Tecmo Bowl thing, right?
Yeah.
People still think of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers from our generation as those creamsicle colors, right? Because absolutely. They stood out. And Houston, I think because I hate the Tennessee Titans' current uniforms and logo so much, that it really does amplify how great these Oilers uniforms were, which I did notice while watching the game. I was like, oh my God, yeah, what great uniforms. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Well, that was the thing back in 1993. I didn't see that many AFC games living in Chicago. It's an NFC town. Right. So I didn't get to see the Bills or the Oilers play a lot. So to see those, the colors and everything, it's fun, right? It was cool.
We're so spoiled in 2023. Oh. You're like, I couldn't watch an AFC game. I was like, I watched the Red Zone on my computer. Every day I see every single game. I'm bored with football.
That didn't exist in 1993. So, but anyway, and you know what? You're right about the Titans. They kind of incorporated those colors, but they added like a dark blue and a gray, and you know, they kind of bastardized them really.
I don't want to go too far off in a tangent because I want you to keep going.
Yeah.
But the Titans redesigned their uniforms in what I consider the dark period of uniform redesigns. It's when the Eagles change their colors to dark green, when the unspeakable Denver Broncos uniforms that exist today came into, like, it's all absolutely a really awful period of uniforms.
Right?
So, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No, I gotcha. I'm with you on that. I we need to go back to the 80s and 90s.
Yes. Oh my God. We're old. So, men. It's tough.
Yeah, we are. So back to the comeback. Well, the Bills and Oilers, I think I had mentioned this earlier. They faced each other for the final game of the regular season, and Houston defeated Buffalo 27-3 in Houston. Okay. Now during that game, Jim Kelly suffered strained ligaments in his knee, and that left backup quarterback Frank Reich to finish the game the last Buffalo in his place.
And try and center in on the problem with Jim Kelly. Now this is Kelly and Thurman Thomas talking to him.
Look at the eyes of the players talking to him. That's really the most telling part of it. They convinced
now,
him.
Now, Reich, he completed a mere 11 of 23 passes for 99 yards in that game with two interceptions and a passer rating of just 23.6. So with Kelly out, Reich was in place to start the following week. Luckily, Buffalo would host the wild card game. Now, in addition to losing Kelly, they also lost Cornelius Bennett, who was a linebacker for the Bills and quite good.
Yep.
At the time,
absolutely,
he was one of their best defensive players. Yeah. He was lost for that wild card game as well. So heading into this game, Frank Reich understood what was at stake. Yeah,
Can I, I don't know if I want, I don't want to step on your story here, but I have a little bit of Frank Reich information if you're going to get into any, like, okay. So I did my research on Frank Reich here. Frank Reich was drafted into the NFL in 1985. He was the 57th overall pick in the third round to the Buffalo Bills. And he stayed in the Bills for 9 years. If you had to guess, Randall, what would you say that Frank Reich's postseason record is?
Oh, okay. I'm going to think, because I'm obviously doing a little bit of research for this. I'm going to go, I don't think he played in that many postseason games. 2-0.
He is 1-2. This is the only postseason, the only postseason game that Frank Reich has ever won in his career. He is
really
he is 40-36. He is 1-2 lifetime in the postseason. 40-31-1 in the regular season with one rogue tie. The reason I bring this up, and I just want to do this real quick because it's something I was thinking about. When you think about the Bills from 89 through 1990, oh, let's call it 1996.
Sure.
It's Jim Kelly and Frank Reich. Reich leaves in 95. Todd Collins is there for 2 years behind Jim Kelly. And then Jim Kelly retires. So I'm going to do this very quickly. I'm going to give you a quick list of all the Buffalo Bills quarterbacks since since Jim Kelly. And you just tell me whether it's a guy you would like to start on your team for any reason. Okay.
Okay.
You tell me.
Yep.
Todd Collins.
No.
Alex Van Pelt.
No.
Doug Flutie.
Yeah.
So, okay, Doug Flutie. All right. Rob Johnson.
No.
Drew Bledsoe. Old Drew Bledsoe.
Yeah. Oh, you mean old in age or old in like...
old in age. He was already done with the Patriots.
Oh, got it. I thought you meant like... Yeah, okay. No.
No. J.P. Lossman.
Who?
Exactly. No. Trent Edwards.
He's a quarterback? No.
Kelly Holcomb.
No. I know.
Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Sure. Yeah. He was fun. Fitzmagic.
EJ Manuel, maybe the worst NFL quarterback drafted in the first round of all time.
Yeah, it's a hard pass.
Ooh, Kyle Orton, former Chicago Bear.
I don't know if I want him starting anything.
Tyrod Taylor.
Yeah.
Nathan, sure. Nathan Peterman.
Oh, Peterman. No Peterman.
And then, of course, Josh Allen in 2018. So that's three quarterbacks from 1997 through 2018. It's a really rough run.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. And if I did a Bears run, it'd be just as bad. So, yeah, I gotcha.
But the only thing I want to make a point is that Frank Reich really never started in his career. He did not take this moment and elevate himself to be a starter somewhere else. He essentially remained a backup for the rest of his career. And we don't have to get too deep in stats. I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah,
there's your little Frank Reich backstory.
No, I gotcha. That's good. Frank Reich heading into this game, he was quoted as saying he felt prepared. He felt the enormity of the moment. He'd already been to two Super Bowls and lost with this team. They know they have a great team. We're on a quest for a Super Bowl. This is our third playoffs. We're trying to make a Super Bowl run. So when Jim gets hurt, there's a lot of pressure.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this game was blacked out on TV in Buffalo because it wasn't a sellout. Now, exactly. I don't know. Do they do sellouts anymore? I mean, do they do blackouts anymore in the playoffs?
When I was growing up, not the playoffs, certainly.
Okay.
I was young enough to remember that happening when I was in my 20s around here, because the Bills were so bad they wouldn't sell out against the Jaguars or something. So they wouldn't, you'd have to go. Yeah. So it did exist relatively recently.
It exists on the regular season, but they would never do that in the playoffs.
No, too much
money. Yeah, but this was exactly too much money. This is blacked out locally in the Buffalo area because it was not a sellout. Overtime.
The Bills stay alive and now face the Steelers next week in Pittsburgh. As Miles said, it basically was a tale of two halves, plain and simple. Unfortunately, many of you folks didn't have a chance to see the game because of the television blackout, but with some help from my buddy Van Miller, who did the game on WGR Radio, we'll relive this baby.
So, now get to the game. The Oilers had gotten off to a really hot start, and the weather wasn't great. There were wind gusts as high as 24 miles per hour. But Houston still dominated the game early. Warren Moon completed 19 of 22 passes for 218 yards and four touchdowns in the first half. And Moon had only played in the second quarter of the previous game against the Bills after missing five straight games due to injury. So you would think he'd be rusty, but there was no rust. He was just running.
Warren Moon is sort of the Trevor Ariza of the NFL, like wrong time, wrong place for his skill set. He'd be the best quarterback in the NFL if you dropped him today into the NFL. They were not ready for him in 1993. Now, like coaches weren't.
Right. As just quick side note, you said you did watch some of this on YouTube because of
I did in preparation.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you notice that, you know, Warren Moon is right-handed. Mm-hmm. And when he took the ball from center, sometimes he would turn to his left.
Mm-hmm. And a little weird.
It was, I'm like, why is he doing that? I don't even know why. And I don't remember it from that, back when he played, but watching it now, I'm like, what is he doing? He's going to his left and then he's still looking to pass the ball.
I think in my mind, I chalk anything from that era up to like whenever I watch like my stepdad play basketball, like a pickup basketball game. I was like, people in that era had weird motions and awkward sort of setups. It was probably like a procedural thing. Like some coach taught him somewhere along the line, you got to get that ball. And because you got to turn. It probably just stuck with him over the years.
It was interesting to see. But anyway, getting back to the game. So the Oilers had held the ball for 21 minutes mm-hmm. and 12 seconds, and they kept the Bills off the field for most of the two quarters, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the Bills did have a pretty good opening drive of the game for them, ending in a 36-yard field goal, but they wouldn't do anything else the rest of the half. And the Oilers took a 28-3 lead into the locker room at halftime. So at this point, now I was just thinking about this. At this point, through six quarters of football, the last game and a half, these two teams have played. Houston outscored Buffalo 55-6. So, you know, I mean, the Bills were booed going into the locker room in the stadium.
There's probably something to be said for Bills fans. Again, I was a kid for this, but, you know, after losing as many Super Bowls as they had, I think there was probably people who were ready for this to sort of be like, yep, here it comes. And I think people were starting to get ready for disappointment, and the disappointment would certainly come in a few years.
Right.
But I think that people were starting to think this window closed. This team had been here multiple times and let them down. Sounds familiar, but this seems to be an overarching theme with the Bills 20, 30 years in a row. Sometimes it's not coaching or players. Sometimes it's culture, which is, I think, why this comeback feels so important, because it's not common for the Bills to be on this side of some wild moment.
So in the locker room, Steve Tasker, who was a Bills special teammate mm-hmm. at the time, he's quoted as saying, we were at halftime and Don Beebe and I were talking. I was asking Don when he was leaving town. We were talking about how fast he was going to get out of town after the season was over. So I mean, that's kind of the mood in the locker room, right? Which is just, you know, I mean, it's reality. They like I said, it's 55-6 in the last six quarters. What were they thinking? Now, obviously, the coach, Marv Levy, at the time, he didn't think it was over. And he walked over to Frank Reich and said, at halftime, I walked over to Frank sitting in front of his locker, very downcast. And I said, Frank, I understand you led the greatest comeback in college football history. Today you're going to lead the greatest comeback in pro football.
Against this team, we felt that we had to take big chances, even if they blew us away 56-0. I told Bruce the first time we score, we're going to kick that nursed onside kick off, whenever that might be. And I told our offensive coaches we're in 2-minute drill.
Now, Sam, I don't know if you saw this in your research for Frank Reich about his comeback.
Oh, I did. I actually have some notes about this. Would this be when he was coming in at halftime against number 6 Miami on November 10th, 1984, considered the greatest comeback in college sports history? What a legacy. What a legacy for Frank.
Exactly. Yeah. They came back from 31-0 down at half to win 42-40, and he beat Bernie Kosar in that game.
31-0 to Miami. Reich led Maryland to six straight scoring drives in the second half. Reich finished with three touchdowns and 260 yards passing as Maryland beat Miami 42-40 in what is still college football's greatest comeback.
You know who you got to feel bad for? Is you got to feel bad for first-string quarterback Stan Gelbaugh, who is replaced by Frank Reich and is now the third guy in this conversation for the rest of his life. He's stuck.
Yeah, exactly.
Shout out to Big Stan. I still feel for you, Stan. Good for you. Yeah, and that was a fascinating thing when I was doing this. It's like he knew what he was doing. He's done this already. This is nothing new for Frank Reich.
Well, when Levy said that, Reich said, I don't want to say I thought he was joking. We were losing by a lot of points. It was no joking matter, but that was vintage Marv Levy, to be able to be both serious and just striking. When he said it, you just know that he believes it can happen, and he's just given me the confidence to know it can happen, right? So, yeah, obviously, Levy is trying to, you know, he's doing what a coach does, right? We're not out of it, guys. We're almost out of it, but we're not out of it.
I actually, that was the thing I noticed while watching Levy in the video, as I watched a little video clip of him. You know, he's not the, he's not like a Tom Landry type guy. He's a bit of an aw shucks guy. He's got an interesting personality for a head coach. I wouldn't expect him to be so sort of casual. You think NFL coaches are like these tough, gruff dudes, but he seemed like just a chill guy. You're like, yeah, good for you, man. Cool, Marv.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Hmm. And Levy also, he said he just nodded his head like, yeah, sure, about Reich when he talked to him. And he said, when we were walking back up the tunnel, the quarterback's coach, Jim Schaffner, said, Coach, the greatest comeback was 28 points. We're only down 25. And I said, oh, Frank doesn't know that, right? And of course, the first, well, it wasn't the first play, but Marv Levy's quoted as saying the first play in the second half, he threw an interception for a touchdown. And that does take us to the second half, where on their first possession, Frank Reich does throw an interception for a touchdown to defensive back Bubba McDowell. And now Houston led 35-3 to start the third quarter.
Intercepted and taken away by the Oilers. Down the left sideline goes Bubba McDowell, and McDowell runs into the end zone.
That's right. Shout out to my paisan, Al Del Greco, one of the few Italian soccer football players I can remember from this era who is really just killing it. And it's funny because I was looking at these numbers, you bringing up the Bubba McDowell thing. That's the crazy part about this, is it's so late in the game when this starts. I'm like, God, they got a 58-yard reception at the start of the third quarter. Yeah. You're like, oh, my God.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. It's the third quarter, 35-3, and a Houston radio announcer, this was immortalized on NFL films with the statement, the lights are on here at Rich Stadium. They've been on since this morning. You could pretty much turn them out now. Oh, you can turn them out on the Bills now. And believe it or not, after that pick six, which, by the way, in 1993, they didn't really call it a pick six. No, it was just an interception. For just a touchdown. But a pick six, after the pick six, fans began, they left. Yeah. They were leaving the stadium because now it's 35-3. And they're like, you got to be kidding. Right. Sort of like, you know, it's 55-6 is one thing. And now add another seven. It's like, forget it.
There probably is a number where I walk away. Like, I'm trying to think, like, in my head, like, I've been to enough Knicks games. Actually, you know, it's funny with the Knicks, it's the opposite. Sometimes I'll leave a game early if they're winning and then just assume that they held on to the lead and that they won, that I can
win. Because you just want to believe
it. Because I wanted to believe that it happened, but it certainly wouldn't. But I guess before you get into the run here.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice this while watching the video. Sometimes, do you believe in momentum? Are you a momentum guy, or do you think momentum's not real? Are you in on this?
I do believe it's real. I mean, think about how many NFL games. I mean, this isn't the only game that's ever been like this. You see games all the time where teams dominate the first half. They might not run up the score as high, but they're clearly dominating the first half. They might be up 17-0. You're like, it doesn't even look competitive. And then all of a sudden, it just changes.
Well, it's almost like, did something happen between this interception and the Ken Davis rush where the Bills just figured something out? How could something possibly change?
Doesn't make any sense.
And I guess maybe it is just like one play, one moment. We see it, and I'm a soccer fan. We see it all the time in a soccer match. One moment shifts momentum incredibly. And that's all I can think of looking at these next five touchdowns. I'm like, how? Yeah,
I know. So the Bills, you mentioned Al Del Greco. They got a huge assist to start their comeback on the ensuing kickoff after this interception. The wind shifted, and the ball that he kicked, it ended up being an unintentional squib kick.
Yep.
So the Bills recovered with tremendous field position, and they drove 50 yards in 10 plays, and they scored a touchdown to cut it to 35-10. So, yeah, you're like, how does it go from 35-3 and Houston has all the momentum and all of a sudden just some random squib kick And all of a sudden they're at midfield and they drive down quickly for a touchdown, 35-10. And then they probably believe there's a chance.
It's the floodgates thing, right? It's the floodgates moment, right? It's like, okay, all we needed was one. All we needed was one moment. I kept thinking, you know, I think that most recently in this Bills loss in the playoffs that we just witnessed, which won't be topical by the time folks hear this, that's all I was thinking. I was like, we can get one touchdown. Maybe we'll get back in this game. And it just did never happen. Like, it didn't materialize.
Right.
Sometimes you just figured it out. I think they got figured out in this scenario. But go ahead. Let's see this run here, because this is like the wide receiver run after this, after that Kenneth Davis touchdown.
It is. So the Bills are still down by 25. And Steve Christie, Buffalo's kicker, he ended up recovering his own kickoff. Now, Marv Levy said that that play was an error and not a planned onside kick. Mm-hmm. However, Steve Christie is quoted as saying, it's called a surprise middle onside kick. I remember telling myself that the ball has to go at least 10 yards, but I'd like it to go 11. They left a gap, not much of a gap, but there was enough room to get it. I slid in there and the ball was there. And then Tasker grabbed me and said, get out of here. They're going to kill you.
So, Steve Tasker, my legend. Yeah,
Steve Tasker. So I don't know, you know, Steve Christie's saying maybe he planned it, but Marv Levy certainly didn't plan it. At least that's what he says.
What's the opposite of like replacing a beloved player? Like, he got the opposite of the having to replace Derek Jeter in New York. They were like, anyone who's not Scott Norwood.
Oh yeah.
They're like, we'll take anybody. Scott Norwood was a great kicker, by the way. So Steve Christie, one of my favorites, by the way, as well. He's actually more of a Buffalo name that sticks with me than Norwood in hindsight. Again, like, that's a name I think of as growing up. Like, oh, yeah, Steve Christie, famed Buffalo Bills kicker.
Sure, sure. So the Bills ended up scoring on the fourth play of the ensuing drive with a Frank Reich 38-yard touchdown pass to Don Beebe. But on this play, Beebe's left foot went partially out of bounds due to momentum caused by a shove by the cornerback, Jerry Gray, with the Oilers. And that was prior to Beebe then getting open for the catch. Officials did not see this. Mm-mm. And in 1993, there was no replay. So had it been something that would have been reviewed, this touchdown wouldn't have counted. Now, that's not to say that they couldn't have still scored. I don't recall. I don't have it in my notes what down and distance this was. But regardless, it wouldn't have counted.
Right.
But, you know, we've watched the NFL long enough to know that, you know, we've seen play. I mean, even in review, now we have reviews and there's still missed calls.
Well, as a history teacher who loves sports, one of the things I have thought about many times over the years is how today's instant replay would have affected moments in the past, right? Yeah. Like immaculate reception does not exist
with
instant replay, right? Like, there's so many moments that they're like, well, that's not a thing, right?
Exactly.
I guess up until like the Tuck rule is the first time when we were like, we're doing replay on all this stuff from now on. But like up until this moment, like everything was just, did some underpaid fat white dude catch this in the corner or not? I can't tell. Touchdown. Yeah, sure. We're just taking your word for it. I guess so. He said it was a touchdown.
It is what it is. Yeah. So at this point, it was 35-17, 7:46 left in the third quarter. And on the next drive, Houston was forced to punt for the first time in the game. So, you know, with 35-17, maybe the defense came to life. Mm-hmm. Like you said, what about momentum here? And then when the Bills got the ball back, Reich then led a drive that ended with a 26-yard touchdown pass to Andre Reed.
And Reich does it again.
Reed at the five, in for the touchdown. Andre Reed has scored.
Reich on the mark, 26 yards to Reed. It was 35-24, and the Bills were down by just 11 with over 4.5 minutes.
After the extra point, it trimmed the lead to 35-24. So in the span of 10 minutes in the third quarter, the Bills had run 18 plays, gained 176 yards, and scored 21 points, and they held the Oilers' offense to 3 plays for 3 yards. So that's a lot of momentum swing.
It's just stunning as I look at this team, how many Hall of Famers are on this team, like how stacked this team is with players. It's insane. Like Andre, first off, where was Andre Reed in the first half? Because he's here for all three of these touchdowns. What happened? Like, what's going on?
Right. What were you doing? No, exactly. How all of a sudden he's wide open. Yeah. I mean, that's just what happened. So the situation did not get any better for Houston. On the first play of the Oilers' ensuing possession, Moon, Warren Moon's pass was tipped off the hands of Slaughter. And the Bills safety, Henry Jones, intercepted the pass from Moon, returned it 15 yards to the Houston 23-yard line. And after a few plays, Reich would connect with Andre Reed for another touchdown. Again, with the extra point, it cut their deficit from 32 points to 4 in a span of just 6 minutes and 52 seconds.
So, well, I just want to want to make a point. We talk about all this action about what happened, and that's the thing I noticed in the highlight is how complicit both of these teams are to their own downfalls. In the first half, if you look at how complicit the Bills' offense and how inept it was, but then if you look in the second half, like what, why is it that suddenly Warren Moon, who ends up in this game with 371 yards passing and 4 touchdowns, where are they in the second half? Like how, where does it all go? Like these numbers are gaudy and they're just gone.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just crazy. So now it's 35-31. And on the Oilers' next drive, Houston was forced to punt yet again. And a 24-yard kick gave Buffalo the ball at the 48-yard line. And so as the third quarter wraps up, Buffalo had outscored Houston 28-7. That 7 came on that interception while holding Warren Moon to 2 of 7 completions for 19 yards. And Houston didn't have a single first down in the third quarter. So this time the Bills couldn't take advantage of their excellent starting position. They had to punt. Happens. And then Warren Moon's run and shoot offense began to move the ball effectively again, briefly, aided by a roughing the passer penalty on Bruce Smith. That happened to negate a Buffalo interception. And despite 2 sacks in the drive, on that drive, Houston reached the Buffalo 14-yard line. And Al Del Greco, you mentioned earlier, we spoke about his unintentional squib kick. So he attempted a field goal to increase the Oilers' lead, but the snap was fumbled. And Daryl Talley recovered the ball for the Bills. He tried to return it 70 yards, but officials ruled him down. So this is a quote from Bubba McDowell. For some reason, we're just letting Andre Reed down the seam. He was killing us. We couldn't even get that right. So they even recognized that what's going on? All of a sudden, Andre Reed is wide open. So on this next drive, guess what happens? The Bills end up having a strong one. Reich went back to passing the ball with just three minutes left in the fourth quarter, and he threw a 17-yard touchdown pass to Andre Reed. That gave Buffalo its first lead of the game at 38-35. So for the first time all season, the Houston defense had never given up more than 29 points, and now they'd given up 38 for the first time all season. Next drive, Warren Moon led Houston down the field for a 63-yard drive that ended up with a 26-yard field goal to tie the game and to send it into overtime.
But the Oilers come back at a 26-yarder from Al Del Greco with 15 seconds to go in regulation. We go to overtime. So it was tied at 38 into overtime.
I think that's the forgotten aspect of this game, by the way, because I think a lot of people think about the comeback. They do forget that the Oilers did actually kick that field goal to tie this game. I think people, that sort of gets washed away in the memory of this game sometimes.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And as this comeback was transpiring, fans were attempting to re-enter the stadium because they had left and they initially weren't allowed to re-enter the stadium after leaving. So they were climbing fences to get back in, and eventually they just allowed them back in for safety reasons, because remember, this game was blacked out locally. So the only way they could hear this comeback was on the radio.
If I know anything about stadiums in this era, once you go outside, you're never coming back in. Don't even think about coming back in. It's never going to happen.
It's a much different time now. So we headed into overtime. Houston actually won the coin toss, got the ball on its 20-yard line. But Moon started out the drive with 2 completions, but his 50th pass attempt of the day turned out to be his last. On 3rd down and 3, Warren Moon threw a pass intended for Ernest Givens.
Yeah.
And Givens was not able to get the ball, and it ended up further downfield into the arms of defensive back Nate Odoms of the Buffalo Bills for an interception. And after a 2-yard return, Houston committed a 15-yard face mask penalty while making the tackle. And that gave Buffalo a first down on Houston's 20-yard line.
I did watch that video earlier. It's an ugly interception from Warren Moon. I was like,
really?
That is an ugly interception. It's bad. It's bad.
Well, Kevin Gilbride, I believe he was the offensive coordinator for the Houston Oilers at the time. He says, I remember saying, what did you do to Warren Moon? And Warren Moon said, what's the difference? It's third down. We had to get it. If we didn't get it, we were going to stop. We weren't going to stop them. We didn't stop them the whole second half. That's what his thinking was. So we kind of forced it in there. Like you said, it was a terrible interception.
Awful, awful interception.
Yeah. So after two runs by Davis, Steve Christie kicked a 32-yard field goal to give Buffalo the win, 41-38.
32 yards from the center of the field. Adam Lingner ready to snap it back. It's 38 all. Bills can win it here. Reich puts it down. The kick is on the way, and it is good. And the Bills have won it. The Bills have won it.
It was an incredible comeback. Fans were obviously going insane at this point, those who stuck around and could get back in. And Steve Christie was saying, as soon as he picked it off, I was telling myself, well, that's it. I better get ready. We're going to win this thing. It's over. It's kind of like, yeah, I hope I get the chance. I hope to God it goes in. And I hope I could just go home after this because it's been the craziest playoff. And that was my first playoff game. That was Steve Christie's first playoff game.
I love Steve Christie. So one of the things I was saying earlier, I asked you about the momentum thing. And I agree with you. I think momentum is real. One thing I don't think is real, and I get made fun of a lot for this, I don't think luck is real. I don't think that Frank Reich was lucky. I don't think the Bills were lucky. I think luck is a combination of preparation and timing, right? The reason that Frank Reich led this comeback, the reason the Bills came back here is not because they were lucky. It's because they had prepared themselves to be in a situation where they could give it at all times. I do have one quick history thing for you. Sure. I did a little bit of research while we were looking. On this day, the day of this game, January 3rd, 1993, if you left the game and got in your car, you could listen to the number one song in America, which was Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You. And Frank Reich, for this, I will always love you. Thank you so much for this. And also, just for a side note, once you get home, if you wanted to rent and watch the number one movie in America, which was not a thing you could do at the time, you'd have to go to a movie theater, you could be watching Disney's Aladdin, number one movie in America. Oh, wow. Yeah, 1993.
Wow.
So we got just a few minutes to close up here. What are your closing thoughts about this game? What about this game speaks to you today? And why does it still feel like it's relevant?
Well, that's a good question. And part of it's why it speaks to me is because I was at what I believe was a Chicago boat show. And I remember seeing it from time to time as we're walking through and just seeing the score go up and up and up. And it's just, you don't remember every game, but I distinctly remembered seeing this. And then, of course, I believe we probably listened to it on the radio on the way home. And everything had changed, right? Mm-hmm. So that's just a memory that stuck with me. And it's always been a comeback that has been intriguing and fun to watch. That's really why it speaks to me. That's why I kind of thought, hey, this is a fun story.
I just want to close out on one last thing before we get out here. Frank Reich, again, as I'm talking about him, Frank Reich kind of made a bigger legacy almost in his post-playing career as a head coach. And I think what's interesting about him as a head coach and a football coach in general, he's coached with the Colts on and off, coaching interim, quarterbacks coach, wide receivers coach for the Cardinals, the Chargers, the Eagles, the Colts. There's a reason why a guy like Frank Reich is a coach, because he is a guy. He's a regular player. There's a reason Michael Jordan was never a coach. You can't expect a player to do what you can do because you're the greatest of all time. But I think a guy like Frank Reich, even though this Indianapolis Colts thing didn't work out for him, I think a guy like that who is a gamer, who's been in there all the time, who feels like part of the bourgeoisie of the league, right? Is just a middle-class guy. I think he speaks to a lot of players about like grit and determination and just being there and giving your all. And that's really what I think of a lot when I think of this game is Frank Reich just doing the everyman's job to try and do his best for his team in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would be remiss if I didn't point this out, and you may not like me pointing this out.
Point it out.
But the Bills did end up going to their third straight Super Bowl, right? But they didn't show up for this Super Bowl at all.
No,
they were facing the Dallas Cowboys. They were blown out 52-17. They committed 9 turnovers in that game. 9 turnovers, 5 fumbles, and 4 interceptions. And they actually had 7 fumbles, but were able to recover 2 of them. Obviously, way too much to overcome against the Dallas Cowboys.
We got what we deserved, and that's why we got that whole list of backup quarterbacks that I read to you earlier, because we blew all our chances with this. No, I would say, and this is not a hot take, of the 4 Super Bowls the Bills went to, there were really only 2 that they actually had a chance in, and that's being generous. Randall, I want to thank you for picking this story. This was a great story this week. We are just closing up here with our time. So
we're just about out of time.
We're just about out of time. So thanks again for joining us here on Sports Out of Time. Randall, I appreciate you. Hope things are good in the Midwest, and we will talk sports soon.
All right, Sam. Thanks.
See you later, brother. Bye.